Expand your mind and let the music be your driving force.
Enter a world of color and light.
And keep on thinking free.
The most eclectic mix of music in the city that never sleeps. At 99.5 FM WBAI New York. And streaming live at www.wbai.org.
Next on What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
We'll show that what happened to Mike Pence wasn't an isolated part of Donald Trump's scheme to overturn the election. In fact, pressuring public servants into betraying their oaths was a fundamental part of the playbook.
I'm Paul Fisher.
This destructive pressure campaign on state and local officials was all based on a lie. Donald Trump knew it. He did it anyway. Second, the lie hasn't gone away. It's corrupting our democratic institutions. People who believe that lie are now seeking positions of public trust. And as seen in New Mexico, their oath to be to the people they serve will take a back seat to their commitment to the big lie. If that happens, who will make sure our institutions don't break under the pressure?
The January 6th committee's focus on Trump's efforts to stay in power zeroed in on his pressure campaign on state and local governments to overturn the election by getting battleground states like Georgia and Arizona to declare Trump the winner in states that Biden won, and send phony elector slates for Trump instead of the certified electors for Biden.
Documents obtained by the Select Committee indicate that instructions were given to the electors in several states that they needed to cast their ballots in complete secrecy. Involved fake electors, those participating in certain states had no way to comply with state election laws, like where the electors were supposed to meet. One group of fake electors even considered hiding overnight to ensure that they could access the state capitol, as required in Michigan.
Did Mr. Norton say who he was working with at all on this effort to have electors meet?
He said he was working with the president's campaign. He told me that the Michigan Republican electors were planning to meet in the Capitol and hide overnight so that they could fulfill the role of casting their vote in per law in the Michigan chambers. And I told him, in no uncertain terms, that that was insane and inappropriate.
In one state, the fake electors even asked for a promise that the campaign would pay their legal fees if they got sued or charged with a crime. Ultimately, fake electors did meet on December 14th, 2020, in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, Nevada, and Wisconsin. At the request of the Trump campaign, the electors from these battleground states signed documents falsely asserting that they were the, quote, duly elected electors from their state, and submitted them to the National Archives and to Vice President Pence in his capacity as President of the Senate. What some of the fake elector certificates look like as compared to the real ones. But these ballots had no legal effect. In an email produced to the Select Committee, Dr. Eastman told a Trump campaign representative that it did not matter that the electors had not been approved by a state authority. Quote, the fact that we have multiple slates of electors demonstrates the uncertainty of either. That should be enough. He urged that Pence act boldly and be challenged. Documents produced to the Select Committee show that the Trump campaign took steps to ensure that the physical copies of the fake electors' electoral votes from two states were delivered to Washington for January 6th.
Trump's direct pressure phone campaign in Georgia is already on the record. But what did the Georgia officials on the receiving end think?
And I watched you this morning and you said, well, there was no criminality, but I mean, all of this stuff is very dangerous stuff. When you talk about no criminality, I think it's very dangerous for you to say that.
Secretary Raffensperger, you wrote about this in your book, and you said, quote, I felt then and still believe today that this was a threat. Others obviously thought so too, because some of Trump's more radical followers have responded as if it was their duty to carry out this threat. Please tell us what you, your wife, even your daughter-in-law experienced regarding threats from Trump's more radical followers.
Well, after the election, my email, my cell phone was doxxed, and so I was getting texts all over the country, and then eventually my wife started getting a text, and hers typically came in as sexualized texts, which were disgusting. To understand that Trish and I, we met in high school, we've been married over 40 years now, and so they started going after her, I think, just to probably put pressure on me, why don't you just quit, walk away. And so that happened, and then some people broke into my daughter-in-law's home, and my son has passed, and she's a widow, and has two kids, and so we're very concerned about her safety also.
And Mr. Secretary, why didn't you just quit and walk away?
Because I knew that we had followed the law and we had followed the Constitution. And I think sometimes moments require you to stand up and just take the shots. You're doing your job. And that's all we did. You know, we just followed the law and we followed the Constitution. And at the end of the day, President Trump came up short. But I had to be faithful to the Constitution. And that's what I swore an oath to do.
Arizona lawmakers were pressured by Trump and company as well, including the Republican Speaker of the Arizona House.
A statement that former President Trump issued, which I received just prior to the hearing. Have you had a chance to review that statement?
My counsel called from Arizona and read it to me.
Yes, sir. In that statement, I won't read it in its entirety. Former President Trump begins by calling you a rhino, Republican name only. He then references a conversation in November 2020. In which he claims that you told him that the election was rigged and that he had won Arizona. And to quote the former president, during the conversation, he told me the election was rigged and that I won Arizona, unquote. Did you have such a conversation with the president?
I did have a conversation with the president. That certainly isn't it. That there were parts of it that are true, but there are parts that are not true.
And the part that I read you, is that false?
Anywhere, anyone, anytime has said that I said the election was rigged, that would not be true.
And when the former president in his statement today claimed that you told him that he won Arizona, is that also false?
That is also false.
And what was his second ask?
That you can remove the electors of President Biden and replace them. And we would like to have the legitimate opportunity through the committee to come to that end and remove that. And I said, that's totally new to me. I've never heard of any such thing. And he pressed that point. And I said, look, you are asking me to do something that is counter to my oath when I swore to the Constitution to uphold it. And I also swore to the Constitution and the laws of the state of Arizona. And this is totally foreign as an idea or a theory to me. And I would never do anything of such magnitude without deep consultation with qualified attorneys. And I said, I've got some good attorneys, and I'm going to give you their names. But you're asking me to do something against my oath, and I will not break my oath.
Speaker Bowers, did the president call you again in later in December?
He did, sir.
Did you tell the president in that second call that you were not going to do anything illegal for him?
I did, sir.
And the attempt to overturn the election included threats and intimidation of election workers.
And those horrible things, did they include threats?
Yes, a lot of threats, wishing death upon me. Telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920.
Were a lot of these threats and vile comments racist in nature?
A lot of them were racist. A lot of them were just hateful. Yes.
We heard President Trump make these false allegations repeatedly during his call with Secretary Raffensperger. Let's listen to a portion of what he had to say about you and your mother.
We had at least 18,000, that's on tape, we had them counted very painstakingly, 18,000 voters having to do with Ruby Freeman, she's a vote scammer. A professional vote scammer and hustler.
Donald Trump attacked you and your mother using her name 18 times on that call. Ms. Moss, can you describe what you experienced listening to former President Trump attack you and your mother in a call with the Georgia Secretary of State?
I felt horrible. I felt like it was all my fault. Like, if I would have never decided to be an elections worker, like, I could have done anything else, but that's what I decided to do, and now people are lying and spreading rumors and lies and attacking my mom, my only child, going to my grandmother's house, her only grandchild, and my kid. It's just, I felt horrible for picking this job and being the one that always wants to help and always there. never missing out one election. I just felt like it was my fault for putting my family in this situation.
Well, it wasn't your fault. Your mother was kind enough to come speak with us earlier. Let's listen to her story and her words.
I'm always concerned of who's around me. I've lost my name and I've lost my reputation. I've lost my sense of security. All because a group of people, starting with number 45 and his ally, Rudy Giuliani, decided to scapegoat me and my daughter, Shay. To push their own lies about how the presidential election was stolen.
Ms. Moss, how has this experience of being targeted by the former president and his allies affected your life?
It's turned my life upside down. I no longer give out my business card. I don't transfer calls. I don't want anyone knowing my name. Don't want to go anywhere with my mom because she might yell my name out over the grocery aisle or something. I don't go to the grocery store at all. I haven't been anywhere at all. I gained about 60 pounds. I just don't do nothing anymore. I don't want to go anywhere. I second guess everything that I do. It's affecting my life in a major way. In every way. Because of lies. For me doing my job, same thing I've been doing forever.
Adamantly denied the idea that any of them gave reconnaissance tours of the Capitol before the January 6th attack. When the January 6th committee said there was evidence otherwise and mentioned GOP Congressman Loudermilk in particular, Loudermilk admitted he gave a constituent tour on January 5th, but denied anything out of the ordinary about it. Now, the committee has released video of Loudermilk's constituent tour of the Capitol, and one of the people in it has been identified as being at the Capitol on January 6th.
There's no escape, Pelosi, Schumer, Nadler, We're coming for you. We're coming in like white on rice for Pelosi, Nadler, Schumer, even you, AOC. We're coming to take you out. We'll pull you out by your hair.
Also, the tour video shows the people with louder milk snapping pictures of places that tourists normally ignore.
And that group showed that type of aggression that day. I mean, they were just here visiting.
Do you regret giving that tour now that they saw what they did eventually?
Well, I condemn that type of activities. Of course, I'd rather not be dealing with this kind of stuff right now, especially for that family's sake. They're scared to death.
But why did you give the tour in the first place if at that time tours weren't really allowed?
There were no tours of the Capitol. We were allowed to bring people into the office. There was no scheduled tour. This family wanted to come visit their congressman. They were coming to Washington. So we told them, well, you could come to my office. We had actually planned to go to lunch with them. But the mayor had shut down. In the meantime, mayor shut down all the restaurants. So they came prepared to go to lunch. So the Longworth cafeteria was open. I took them to the Longworth cafeteria. The majority had ordered the gift shop to be open that day because they knew how many visitors.
The House committee renewed its call for Loudermilk to testify about this.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, we have not accused Representative Loudermilk of that. We said we wanted to talk to him. That he won't talk to us is concerning to me. Obviously, he led a tour. I mean, they took a video of the tunnel from the Rayburn Building to the Capitol. That was the same tunnel. The next day, I was evacuated through that tunnel from the House floor. They took video of the stairwell that led into the Ways and Means Committee room, where like 100 or so members of Congress were sheltered in place after the evacuation from the Capitol. So we'd like to know about this. And, you know, to say he actually filed an ethics complaint, that was bizarre when he knew he himself led a tour. And let's remember that the Capitol was completely closed to the public because of the COVID. One of the Capitol police told me yesterday that they were told that they couldn't even bring their own families into the Capitol complex. It was completely closed.
I think the banana Republicans who are saying that what happened on January 6th was nothing or okay are undermining the basic credibility of our country's institutions. And that in turn feeds through for inflation. Because if you can't trust the country's government, why should you trust its money? So I think it's terribly important that we take the temperature down in Washington, that we recognize behavior that's just out of bounds. of reasonable and decency. We give the Fed the room it needs. We bring down the budget deficit. We take down prices directly through prescription drugs. This is a challenge that we can meet if we're prepared to be serious about taking it on.
I think the bottom line for the committee is this. Was there an effort to overturn the legitimate election of the United States? What was January 6th in relation to that? And what is the rot in our system that led to that, and does it still exist today? You know, with conspiracy theories, as we've seen, you know, reported, this idea of releasing the Kraken, or that the CIA attacked the DOD or was attacked by the DOD in Germany. John, like half of the country at one point believed some of that stuff. And this is a roadmap for how to overturn a legitimately elected government. So this is important. We're going to get to the bottom of this. And as we're seeing in Ukraine, people are willing to die for democracy. We at least have to be willing to put careers on the line for the same cause.
Dan Rather, and you're listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth, with musical host Paul Fisher in New York City.
The bipartisan Senate group was working to write and pass some modest gun measures before the 4th of July recess. That Mitch McConnell's point man in the group, Senator John Cornyn, got booed at a GOP convention back home in Texas. One sticking point, closing the so-called boyfriend loophole. Denying guns to people with a record of abuse against their partners. Even if they aren't married or don't even live together. Of course, that begs the question, why should you have a gun if you have a record of abuse at all?
Something like this happens, that we not legislate under the heat of the moment. Under great emotion, without looking at the text and figuring out what we're doing. And we need to be careful that we not punish law-abiding Americans for the wrongs carried out by the criminally minded and the insane.
So Fox
Axios polling shows that there is a lot of strength behind some of these proposals at this point, some of these proposals. Background checks for guns, which by and large, most of them are background checked before you do a purchase. 88%, though, moving the legal age for an assault rifle purchase as it. Flagging for people who are a danger to themselves or others as red flag laws, 81%, and banning assault weapons, 63%. There is a lot of momentum, at least among the public sphere, for doing this. Are you out of step with your constituents?
Okay, so first of all, what's important is that we look out for the rights of constituents. Constituents are asked poll questions. They're not asked questions about specific language within legislative text. It's the job of the lawmaker to look out for the interests and the rights of the law-abiding citizens they represent.
The bill's final text did close the boyfriend loophole before facing a final Senate vote.
We've got a good group, a bipartisan group that's helped lead the negotiations here that I think we can get out of the Senate this week and to the president's desk before the end of next month. I've been a part of other efforts in the last decade to try and pass universal background checks and to try and do other things. It's been maddeningly difficult.
For sure.
I am still hopeful we can get this done, but we can't count our chickens. We can't count our eggs before they hatch, forgive me, because, you know, frankly, this deal almost came apart several times over last weekend.
Our purpose this morning is simple, to sound the alarm about the water crisis in the American West.
It only seems fitting.
One fine morning, just after dawn, my love and I riding.
That as the West was bracing for another record heat wave, a Senate panel was meeting to discuss the water shortage crisis in the West.
Slipping and sliding.
And there was also that headline about how the Great Salt Lake in Utah is now a lot less great and with a lot less water. About half the water volume it used to be. Because surging population growth with or without climate change. And if that wasn't bad enough, the drying lake area could produce toxic dust that would blow into populated areas. So, as for that Senate hearing on the mega drought.
The West has not been this dry in 1,200 years.
Down the road a ways, the hills ablaze, looking for reason.
1,200 years. If we don't get our act together here, it's going to not only put our Western agriculture at risk, but the American West as we know it. My state sits at the headwaters of the Colorado River, which starts as snowmelt in the Rockies before cutting across 1,400 miles to the Sea of Cortez. The Colorado River Basin is the lifeblood of the American Southwest. It provides the drinking water for 40 million people across seven states and 30 tribes. It irrigates 5 million acres of agricultural land. It underpins the West's $26 billion outdoor recreation and tourism economy, and it is running out of water.
Just last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration deemed April as one of the driest months on the record in the last 100 years. Currently, over half of Kansas is designated moderate drought, and over a third of the state is designated as severe. Just last week, the Topeka Capital Journal reported that the projected wheat yield in Kansas is expected to drop by over 100 million bushels. I think that's about 30% of our average yield. That's a value of over $1 billion to the state of Kansas. This lack of rain not only hurts farm production at its most crucial time, but it also adversely affects ranchers and families.
When I was a girl.
Fall victim to raging wildfires, and yes, we've had horrible prairie fires the past several years.
My name is Andy Mueller. I'm the general manager of the Colorado River Water Conservation District.
When I was a girl in Colorado, winter.
As a regional government, we lead in the conservation, development, and protection of the headwaters of the Colorado River in a 15-county area in western Colorado. The precipitation in our district alone provides 65% of the Colorado River's annual average flow. We're the first link in an immense chain vital to the health and future of the single most important natural resource in the American Southwest. The Colorado River is aptly referred to as the hardest working river in America. Even in wet years, the river no longer reaches its natural mouth of the Sea of Cortez, and claims to water exceed its annual average flow every year. The massive system of federal reservoirs on the Colorado River was designed and built to accommodate the known natural variability in the river system and worked extremely well for over 50 years.
When I moved out to the desert.
However, the longest and most severe drought on record, that once highly functioning federal system is dangerously depleted, with only 34% of system storage remaining, forcing the Department of Interior and the basin states last year and this year to resort to emergency actions to keep the system from collapse.
When I go back to the mountain.
Over the last 22 years, the flows of the Colorado River have been 20% below average, and sound science tells us we should anticipate and plan for significant reduction in flow in the future.
Situation in the West is dire. We have heard about the Colorado River Basin, the 40 million people and 5 million acres that are challenged with low water supply. The situation in the Great Plains is similar in the fact that over time we are receiving less precipitation and are challenged by drought. Each year when we have less precipitation, that means that our farmers are pumping more water, exacerbating the declines of the Ogallala Aquifer. This is a vital resource for our region, and if we don't act, we'll end up with a situation with that resource going away, as well as the agricultural production that's associated with that irrigation.
Water is at the center of what we do as an organization. Western states have lost between 20 and 90% of their original wetlands through direct drainage and conversion of wetlands. Others have been lost through the diversion of source water for other uses. It will come to no surprise that drought is further exacerbating wetland loss. This has had a profound effect on water birds and other wetland-dependent wildlife, as well as the important ecological functions wetlands provide to people by capturing floodwater, augmenting river flows, recharging deep aquifers, and regulating climate. The drought situation is dire. However, when I can, I want to offer solutions on the role of Farm Bill programs and other programs like the National Wetlands Conservation Act. Wetland restoration in states like Colorado and Kansas can be part of the drought mitigation solution. We have heard from other witnesses about flow retiming. With subsurface connectivity tend to regulate hydrology by capturing water during snowmelt or flood periods and direct that water through shallow subsurface flows, providing a constant subsurface discharge to streams and rivers during drought periods. Projects offset agricultural well depletion, supplement base flow during dry periods, and provide habitat for waterfowl, wading birds, cranes, and other threatened and endangered species.
You and ask you, assuming we move forward as we are now with no changes to our water use and no meaningful action to slow climate change, can you describe what you think the Colorado River Basin will look like in 20 years or 40 years? Could you give the committee also a little bit of a sense about what is happening in Lake Powell and Lake Mead as well?
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator. I would say I'm not 20 or 30 years from now, the Colorado River Basin will be a starkly different place if we don't act quickly and act intelligently. All of the scientific consensus is clear that we will are facing a situation where we can expect as additional cuts to the flow of the Colorado River as great as 30%. So a 50% reduction from 20 years ago. This isn't a river system that, again, is already over-appropriated and overused. What that means is that we will have great conflict between our growing cities in the river basin and our national food supply. It means that if we stick together, we might finally shine the light. The price and value of water will exceed the current value of agricultural production water. And it is likely that our agriculture in the Colorado River Basin will be greatly diminished. It is a situation that is dire.
During the Skylab 3 second manned flight on the 23rd day of 1973,
it was interesting to hear the news that NASA is now going to investigate UFOs, or UAPs as they're called now, unidentified aerial phenomena.
Skylab crew understood a large star-shaped object right over the
sky. Interesting, because it never occurred to me that NASA hasn't been looking into UAPs before now. After all, NASA has been launching probes into the solar system for decades, looking for any signs of life on other planets. Not to mention telescopes that can see to the far edges of the universe, including the Webb telescope that will now be able to analyze the atmospheres of exoplanets way beyond our solar system. And not to mention all those satellites in Earth orbit that not only look out into space, but look down on Earth. So So I just assumed that with NASA looking for signs of life out there, they were also looking to see if any of that life was coming here for a visit in UFOs. So what's the new NASA program to investigate UAPs, and who's running it? The team includes a former astrophysics chair at Princeton and NASA Associate Administrator for Science, Thomas Serbukhin, explained what NASA is doing.
I want to first say that, of course, part of our task at NASA is given to us by the Congress is not only to do fundamental research in the skies and so forth, but as part of that, also to find life elsewhere. That's why we've built astrobiology programs in many disciplines across the submarine field that looks at extinct life on Mars, for example, but also looks at patterns of life elsewhere, perhaps in Europe, perhaps in Enceladus as we go forward, but also as we look at exoplanets, planets outside of our solar system, looking for the question whether certain environments are in fact part of kind of the, if you want, the ladder of life that got us to where we are.
Right.
So the tools that we're using, whether it's in this field, they're also kind of in fields that then go towards kind of intelligent life, such as techno signatures, which we have programs for already, are the same tools that we use everywhere, the tools that we're frankly using here. And that is to be commissioning a study to start early in the fall to examine unidentified aerial phenomena. The study will focus on identifying available data, how to best collect future data, and how NASA can use these data to move the scientific understanding of UAPs forward. The way I would talk about that is take a field that is relatively data poor make it into a field that is much more data rich and therefore worthy of scientific investigation and analysis. NASA's mission, of course, as I just said, is to explore the unknown in air and space. And we have access, frankly, as part of that, to a broad range of observations of Earth and space. And frankly, that's the lifeblood of our scientific inquiry. We have the tools and teams who can help us improve our understanding of the unknown. And we are prepared to use these powerful tools of scientific discovery in this case, as much as anything else, using exactly the same kind of approach that we always use. Unidentified phenomena in the atmosphere are of interest for many reasons. Frankly, I think there's new science to be discovered. There's been many times where something that looked almost magical turned out to be a new scientific effect. But there's also national security and air safety issues that have been discussed elsewhere that, of course, relate to these observations. And establishing, with events that are, whether they're natural or whether they are, kind of need to be explained otherwise, is very much aligned with NASA's goals ensure, of course, that we discover the unknown, but also ensures the safety of aircraft that, of course, are in that airspace that these phenomena occur. This independent study will be led by astrophysicist David Spergel, who's the president of the Simons Foundation in New York City and has previously been the chair of astrophysics in the Department of Princeton and University of Princeton, New Jersey.
I think one of our starting points of this is
there are phenomena that we don't understand. How do we start to make progress? We have a very limited set of observations right now with these UAPs. This makes it difficult to draw conclusions. So we start by trying to figure out what data is out there. And we're going to be working with government, nonprofits, companies, civilians, and try to identify what data is already there. Then start to think about what data should we collect in the future and how are we going to analyze it. We actually have a wealth of data about our atmosphere that we observe it both from above and below. And whether it's air traffic management data, astronomers looking up, satellites looking down. And what we want to start with is just synthesizing the data we have and see what information we have and see what information we need. And our plan is to conduct an open inquiry that we hope will advance our understanding so that when this is done, we at least have a roadmap. How to move forward in understanding.
But you want to underscore that NASA is uniquely positioned to address UAPs, because who other than us can use the power of data and science to look at what's happening in our skies? And quite frankly, this is why we do what we do. For this study specifically, we plan on bringing together some of the country's leading scientists, aeronautics experts, and data practitioners. We expect the study to kick off in the early fall. It should take about 9 months to complete. And I want to make this point emphatically, that very much consistent with our principles of openness, transparency, and scientific integrity, the full report will be made available to the public, and we expect to hold a public meeting to discuss the study findings.
To be great. He had a chance to be, frankly, historic. But just like Bill Barr and the rest of these weak people, Mike, and I say it sadly because I like him, but Mike did not have the courage to act.
He calls Mike Pence weak, says, I think he called him a conveyor belt. This public admission that essentially he wanted continues after laying out all this evidence is he confessing?
Yeah, he's essentially saying, yeah, I did it and I'll do it again, which is what we have been contending all along, that if you allow impunity for attempts at unconstitutional seizures of power, which is what a coup is, then you're inviting it again in the future. And to be a strong, self-sustaining, self-respecting democracy, we can't allow people to decide that they are above the law and that they are more important than our constitutional processes.
And for the complete playlist of music and sound bites on the program, you can go to the program's Facebook page. What's the Frequency, Paul? Hi, Paul Fisher.